discussions in the past about the Bogdan Group. Today, we face a whole series of environmental and population problems, which are in fact the largest threats to human society in the world. And they're frequently discussed. We read about the problems of habitat damage, deforestation, water problems, soil erosion problems, toxic waste, pest species, global climate change, population differential impact. These are all problems of our making. What can we learn from the past to help us meet these problems? Because there were some past societies that solved it and others didn't. We don't have to repeat the mistakes of the past. I'd say that there are the three deepest lessons that I came away with in my book. One is a simple one. It is take environmental and population problems seriously. They are not something to be dismissed because they did in many past societies. Even those past societies consisted of just 6,000 Mangalevans with stone tools. And today we've got 6.5 billion people with steel tools. The 6,000 Mangalevans with stone tools could destroy their environment. You better believe that 6.5 billion people today with nuclear power and steel tools can do it. Environmental problems have to be taken seriously. The second of these three deep lessons is something that I realized only in the last few months of my work on it. Among those past societies that failed, a common message was a blueprint for failure is a society whose political elite, whose governors, are able to insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions. That was the case with my Mayan kings remained well-fed because they were, in effect, taxing the commoners, and they had a luxury life. They did not pay attention to the problems of soil erosion, deforestation, rendering. Instead, they were preoccupied with the Maya equivalent of the next election, which is fighting against other kings and trying to prevent a revolt and put down upstarts. And the result was that the Maya kings did not, being insulated from the consequences of their actions, they did not solve their society's problems, and Maya society collapsed. The kings had merely bought themselves the privilege of being the last to starve. Other societies, though, in which the elite, those who govern, are not insulated from the consequences of their actions, have been much more successful. For example, the Netherlands today, Holland, is, I believe, the country of which the highest percentage of its citizens belongs to environmental organizations, something like half of all Dutch belong to environmental organizations. And I never understood why until my second last trip to Holland, when I was riding with some bird watching friends, and I raced through Holland and I raised this question, why are you Dutch so concerned about the environment? And I'll never forget what my friend said. He said, just look around you. This land, you see those dikes? This land is below sea level. One third of the Netherlands is below sea level. And it's kept clear of water by pumps going constantly and by the integrity of the dikes. But in the Netherlands, it's not the case that the rich people live up on top of the dikes and the poor people live down below what's called the polders, the low-lying drain areas. It's that everybody, rich or poor, lives in the low-lying drain areas. And if our dikes and our water pumping system fail, everybody, those in the government, the rich and the poor, alike will drown. And there was an example in vivid recent memory of the Dutch. In 1953, February 1, 1953, the Zeeland floods, water streamed inland, something like 50 miles inland, and 3,000 Dutch people, rich and poor, drowned. And the Dutch swore that would never happen to them again. And so the political leaders in the Netherlands made sure that the Dutch spent billions and billions and billions of dollars erecting a system of dikes and effective pumps and dams. That's a society that successfully solved its problems, precisely because the elite were damned in the same problem as everybody else. That recognition is one that frankly worries me in the present United States. In the last couple of decades, I believe that I've seen an increasing insularization of wealthy people from the problems of society. That's particularly vivid in Los Angeles, where we have many gated communities, communities surrounded by gates with a sign, private and dirt. And these gated communities for wealthy people, they don't depend on the police force, but they've got their private security guards. They don't depend on public water supply because they drink bottled water. They don't depend on public schools because they send their kids to private schools. They don't depend on Medicaid because, of course, they have private health insurance. And they don't depend on Social Security because they've got their own privately funded pensions. So they are not motivated to solve, they're not personally motivated to solve problems of Social Security and Medicare and public water supplies and the police force and public schools, because they've succeeded in insulating themselves from the direct consequences of these problems. But you can bet that if the United States develops severe problems, those gated communities are not going to remain intact. And again, living in Los Angeles, I remember well the riots of 1993 and the earlier riots, when there were riots in poor sections of Los Angeles, and I remember well the plastic yellow tapes. There was fear that the poor rioters would stream into and sack the wealthy areas of Los Angeles, and so the police put up police lines, yellow pieces of plastic tape, across the wealthy communities, and if poor people had to return, there was no way that the yellow tape was going to keep out of the rioters. That's one of my worst-case scenarios, that it's not, I think, an unlikely one for the United States if those in power continue to insulate themselves from the problems of the rest of society. And then, finally, the remaining deep lesson has to do with core values. Those societies that collapse in the past often collapse by clinging to the core values that have been the greatest source of their strength, beyond the point at which those core values were appropriate. The hardest things to give up are those things that have been the source of your strength and survival in the past. And so, for example, the Greenland Norse, here they had succeeded in setting up a pastoral Christian European society on a rather cold island in Greenland, a one-week journey, dangerous journey by ships from Norway. And there were only 5,000, but they maintained their sanity and their success for 450 years. By their unifying values of being a Christian European society. That was the source of their strength, and at the end it was the source of their downfall, because when the Inuit, the Eskimo, came into Greenland with, frankly, a superior subsistence economy based on hunting, and when the climate got colder, the Inuit, who were catching fish and hunting ringed seals and going to sea in kayaks that were not made of wood and harpooning, but the Greenland Norse as European Christians, there was no way that they were going to learn from those pagan Inuit. In fact, the Greenland Norse term for the Inuit was skraelings, which means wretches. And of course, you're not going to get help from wretches. And so the Greenland Norse did not learn how to fish or hunt ring seals or kayaks or harpooning. And because they clung obstinately to their core values that had served so well and did so no longer, they ended up all dead. In the United States, core values that have served us well in the past, but about which I'm uncertain whether they will serve us well in the future, are our values of isolationism and plenty. George Washington warned Americans against entangling alliances. And it was good advice, as long as the United States was effectively shielded from its enemies by the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. But today the oceans are no longer shielded. We cannot be isolated. After World War I, we got involved with the rest of the world, and then we retreated into isolation. Nowadays, any country in the world can cause trouble for the United States. 20 years ago, if you would ask a politician, name some of the countries in the world of most geopolitical irrelevance to the United States, the politician would say, well, poor landlocked countries like Afghanistan and Somalia would never be concerned about them. But Somalia and Afghanistan, in today's globalized world, any country can cause us trouble, and American troops have gone in there. So our isolationism of the past no longer serves us well in this globalized world. Yes, we can seek short-term solutions, military solutions, when that country or that country blows up. But we've seen in the last 3 years that the short-term military solutions cost about $100 billion and 150,000 troops per country. But there are several dozen countries out there waiting to become the next Iraq and Afghanistan and Somalia. There is Nepal and Indonesia and the Philippines and Afghanistan and Haiti and Rwanda, etc., etc. Even the United States, the richest country in the world, can put $100 billion or 150,000 troops into each of two dozen countries. We have to become involved in our own self-interest with the rest of the world, and doing so is both a long run cheaper and more efficacious. So that's one core value of isolationism that we Americans must painfully reassess. And the other core value waiting a painful reassessment is our sense of unlimited resources. For a couple of hundred years, the United States has been the country of the endless frontier, the country of endless plenty, of the opportunity to consume and become rich. And it worked as long as our own resources were effectively infinite, and as long as the world's resources were effectively infinite. But that is no longer the case. The first world alone is already utilizing resources at a rate that is not sustainable. And if the third world achieves its goals of catching up to our first world exploitation rates, if China alone were to achieve first world per capita oil consumption and steel consumption, that would double the consumption of oil and steel around the world. And if the remaining third world countries were to catch up to the first world of our consumption rates, that would increase consumption around the world, human impact by a factor of 10. Nobody, I think, could reasonably maintain that the world could stand and increase in human impact by a factor of 10. It's as if we would have not 6.5 billion people, but 65 billion people. So the United States is going to have to come to grips with the consumerism that suited it well in the past, but no longer. The solution certainly is not going to be first worlders continuing to say, we will practice our first world living standards, and you out here in the third world carry on as you want that. Because the third world has television and videos and sees stores, and it sees what are the living standards in the first world, and it inspires them. And it's seeking to achieve first world living standards in two different ways. One is that many third world governments are striving to catch up. For example, the government of China, which has the highest economic growth rate of any big country in the world, the Chinese want to catch up to the world's first world living standards. And we in the first world cannot tell the Chinese, we'll continue to do it, but will you? The Chinese will do what they please. And then also individuals in the third world seek to attain first world living standards by voting with their own feet and immigrating. And the borders are porous not only in the United States, but also in Europe, which is overflowing with immigrants from Eastern Europe and from further afield. Even on a micro level, my family and I spent our Christmas vacation in Costa Rica, and Costa Rica, neighboring Nicaragua, and two or three times richer than Nicaragua. All the sentences in here in Southern California about those people, those Hispanic immigrants, they take poor jobs, they require, they make demands on our medical services, and they want driver's licenses, and they want to send their children to our schools, and they're a burden on our economy, but we need them to provide jobs, and they have a different language and a different culture. All of those sentences, you replace Hispanic Americans and existing Americans with Nicaraguans and Costa Ricans, and you've got the situation in Costa Rica. So around the world then, third worlders are trying to catch up to the first world. There's no way that the first world can maintain its consuming standards that it has at present. Something has got to change, and that change will have to be adopted our resource consumption to sustainable levels.